So the talk title was Jets Across Different Types of Objects, Neutron Stars, and Black Holes. So when I realized, I hastily added a few slides to try and give an overview of jets everywhere. So jets are everywhere. If we start talking with black hole jets, then we have big black holes and small black holes. Small black holes can be binary systems, binary mergers, that a lot of discussion is going on about this at the parallel meeting, and core collapse gamma ray bursts. So these things, these are the things that are exploding. These are the things that are happening fast, microquasars happening, in dynamical timescales of tens of milliseconds. Here, dynamical scales are of minutes or hours. So if we are impatient, we should be looking here, as per Roger Blanford. If we would like to see the exquisite details of slow motion, then we should be looking here. Of course, the mass scaling is a little bit broken because of radiation effects, as we discussed earlier. Yan-Fei Zhen talked about that. Things might not be exactly the same, so it's not just the time scale difference. In addition to small and big black holes, there are intermediate mass black holes. We still don't quite understand exactly where they occur. They could be the small mass end of these big guys, or it could be high mass end of the small guys. Regardless, this is something that is extremely interesting. If there are intermediate mass black holes, that will help us grow big black holes, and understanding where they came from would be very fascinating. In addition to just black holes and neutron stars can be present as a result of core collapse or in binary mergers. We just have accretion neutron stars and binary systems, or we can have normal stars. And you can see that all of these guys, including these, they produce jets. So jet production is something that's very robust. It doesn't seem to care not only about the size of the black hole, small, intermediate, big. We doesn't even care about the type of the central object. So it seems what we care is magnetic fields and accretion onto the central objects, and that's all we require. Whether the central object has its own magnetic flux, like here, or doesn't, like here in the black hole case, doesn't seem to matter.
Are magnetic fields absolutely required? I mean, I tend to agree, but what evidence is there that it has to be magnetic?
Well, we see synchrotron emission, so there are magnetic fields. Whether they're dynamically important or not, that is another level of this question. We see Faraday rotation. We can measure strengths of magnetic fields, as I will mention. So the fact that there are magnetic fields there, it seems like it's quite well confirmed observationally. Having said that, there are other ways of driving outflows. That could be line driving, radiation dominated, radiation effects producing the outflows. One thing that I'm confident of is if you see a relativistic outflow from the active galactic nucleus or from a neutron star, magnetic fields are perhaps the only way you can do this. Because if you see something that's moving at Lorentz factor of 10 or 100, then you would have had to start with one type of energy dominating all the other types of energy, or the Rasmus energy at least. And if you have energy much greater than mc squared somewhere, what form can you hide it in? In the case of AGN, it's very hard to hide that dominant component of energy in the form of radiation. So perhaps the only one is the silent form of magnetic fields. So I'm pretty confident that magnetic fields are what powers the relativistic, at least the relativistic parts of outflows. But then there are so many other outflows, disk outflows. We see lines, sea line driven winds, evidence for those. And there is a lot of effort going on understanding those. So I won't be touching these. I will really try to focus on this scale invariant type part of the physics, which magnetic fields seem to be a really good candidate for.
Some of the other possibilities, like radiation, for example, are much less likely to be important for young stars. So if you want one mechanism across all of them, magnetic fields.
Sure.
Related question. These are all accreting sources. And what about jets from pulsars, for example? Do you think they are related?
Right. Yeah, I didn't want to touch on those. So in a sense, you don't need accretion in order to get a jet. You need something that holds magnetic fields together, prevents them from just opening up and falling apart, like would happen if this neutron star were isolated. The field lines would just extend out to infinity and be radial. So if you put an obstacle even far away, that obstacle will cause these magnetic field lines to bunch up and converge towards the pole, and that's all you need in order to get a jet. Those pulsar jets, like in Vela or in Krupp-Gold pulsar, are kind of wimpy-ish. They look very unstable. We think we understand pretty well what happened, how they occur. But I would put them in a different category than these. This is a good point. Happy to talk more about that. But I wasn't planning on focusing on those. So just to inject a little bit of energy here and excitement, this is like every single facet of these jets has had something new added to it in the past several years. This is a prediction by famous Russian Soviet at the time painter Amalevich, who predicted gravitational waves. This is the painting Black Square. We don't see anything from the mergers of binary black holes, but we can hear gravitational waves. So this was a really big, exciting piece of news in the past year or so. These binary mergers are probably responsible for these gravitational waves. At least the black hole ones, perhaps we will soon detect neutron star mergers. Speaking about neutron star mergers, there have been perhaps several tentative detections of kilonova emission from binary mergers. When you have a neutron star merging with another neutron star or with a black hole, this produces a neutron-rich outflow that has nuclear reactions going on. There are processes produces heavy nuclei that then decay and power radioactively emission, which is coined kilonova. It's really bright. It's mostly isotropic, so it's a perfect electromagnetic counterpart to such mergers, as opposed to collimated jets like that. So that's really exciting. With the advent of all sky surveys, we will probably be catching more and more of these, and that will allow us to revolutionize our understanding of black hole accretion in these explosions.
Sasha, can you just give us a very brief observational overview of whether or not, right, there was one source a couple years ago, and some people said it was a kilonova, some people said it wasn't.
It was one data point one filter that showed an excess over the usual afterglow light curve that was, and this filter was very red. So there were two works that claimed that this was a signature, telltale signature of kilonova. There were also two earlier papers, whose details are a bit vague in my mind right now, that were also claiming kilonova bumps in other sources like gamma ray bursts. But I wouldn't say that there is agreement that any of those detections were actually detections of kilonovae. They were detections of something, but it's not clear whether it was a kilonova.
And with either of them, presumably with the one data point in the red filter source that I'm thinking of, there was not a possibility of sort of late time follow-up because it was too faint, is that correct?
Yeah, it would have faded by that time, yeah.
But people then presumably have been looking since then, but the occurrence rate is sufficiently low that it's not surprising.
Would be consistent. It would be totally consistent with kilonovae happening at some reasonable rate and us not detecting them. Dark Energy Survey was working really hard to try and detect kilonovae, and no detections followed. It's quite possible that we're looking in the wrong place. Maybe kilonovae are not as red as we think. Maybe they're bluer, because first principles modeling of kilonovae is actually quite challenging. And I actually have some slides on that, not in this talk, but I can switch to another one and show you if you guys are interested. I'm doing some work on that. So what else has happened that was exciting? Well, there was a detection of a very long, ultra-long duration gamma ray burst that lasted for 10,000 seconds. And it seems like it was accompanied by a superluminous supernova that is a magnetically driven explosion. So it's a mystery. I don't understand how Magnetic fields can both penetrate the star and evacuate the energy out to infinity, which is done through jets, and at the same time explode the star. You know, one or the other. Don't quite get how that happens. So it's a mystery, quite exciting. Of course, there was a detection of pulsations by the Neutrostar satellite from one of the ultraluminous X-ray sources. I think there are now three overall. So it seems like there are many, many ultraluminous X-ray sources which we thought were powered by intermediate mass black holes, whereas in reality, these are little guys, not intermediate mass black holes, and these are neutron stars. So that's really challenging to anticipate, and it's a surprise. So trying and understanding the physics of these sources is quite exciting. And last but not least, there were several detections of tidal disruptions, that is a star coming too close, uncomfortably close to a supermassive black hole and getting torn into shreds by the tidal gravity of the black hole and powering not only just the optical and X-ray flare like we usually expect from the accretion disk emission, but also producing jets that happen to point at us and produce high energy emission. One of the well-known sources like this is Swift J1644. Because such disruptions are very well defined, or you would expect so, you know, you have one solar mass reservoir of mass, you have a pretty good idea what the supermassive black hole mass is. It seems like there are very few parameters, and so this is a very well-calibrated laboratory for studying accretion, and if there is also jet coming out, that's perfect. We will also be able to try and use these nature-generated laboratories for our advantage. It turns out that these show huge variety, very many different faces. It actually turns out to be a much more complex system than we thought. Lots of very non-trivial opacity effects. So it requires much more deeper study. Still, this is a quite exciting laboratory. And I'm also working a little bit on this, so I'm happy to talk about this in more detail, but I didn't add any slides here. So let me move on to this invariant, scale invariant physics of jet production. And this is my favorite cartoon for explaining how jets work in general. It could be an isolated neutron star, then remove this ambient medium. If it's not an isolated neutron star immersed into some ambient medium, then let's put a ceiling here that
How they work from computers?
How they work in the lab, in a computer, or in, I think, in reality. At least that's.
But you don't. You never have T0 in reality.
You could.
Situation.
You could. I mean, as a result of core collapse, for instance, when you've just formed a compact object. Then you can assign T0 to it, perhaps. Of course, in an active galactic nucleus, this is an idealization. But you can think of it as the black hole just got large-scale magnetic field lines from an accretion disk, call that T equals 0, and then ask, how will this magnetic flux navigate? You know, it will be sheared at the bottom. It will be sheared at the bottom by the rotation of the neutron star. It will try to navigate the obstacle, which is the gas that's sitting around the black hole. What will happen? And so this is a cartoon that tries to address that. Any other questions? OK, so we have the ambient medium. I represent it with a perfectly conducting ceiling, OK? So I attach a magnetic field line by one end to the ceiling, by the other end to the central compact object, which here I represent through a perfectly conducting sphere. Could be neutron star, normal star, black hole, white dwarf, anything you like that has a spherical shape. So attached the field line to this one, spun it up at T equals 0 at an angular frequency omega, weight and rotations of the central sphere.
In the case of black holes, though, you don't actually thread the event horizon, right?
It depends on your viewpoint. If you are looking at a movie of black hole eating up magnetic flux in Bohr-Lindquist coordinates, then true, because of the redshift effects, the magnetic field lines will actually never cross the event horizon. They will always be just outside, you know, epsilon away from the black hole event horizon. If you are actually falling in with the magnetic field line, or you drop a camera, then, well, you wouldn't be able to get a movie, but the camera will actually disappear in its own time, you know, in a finite amount of time. If you choose coordinates that try to be less aggressive at keeping away from the black hole than Bowen-Lindquist coordinates, where they avoid the coordinate singularity at the black hole horizon, like Kirchhoff coordinates, then in this case, actually the magnetic field line will thread the black hole event horizon. It just depends on the time slicing that's used in the coordinate system. And that turns out to be, at least in my experience, a more intuitive picture, where the black hole behaves as a normal, maybe perhaps a little bit resistive sphere, where the field lines can go in and penetrate it. So anticipate another question. There is no surface for a black hole. What are you talking about? Perfectly conducting sphere surface. It turns out that if you look at the black hole thread with magnetic field lines, then actually the black hole will rotate, cause the space-time to rotate. The space-time will cause magnetic field lines to rotate, and they rotate at about half the angular frequency of the black hole event horizon. So if you were to take the black hole out, replace it with a perfectly conducting sphere rotating at half the black hole event horizon frequency, almost nothing would change, apart from the fact that the accretion wouldn't be able to, you know, disappear in the surface. But if we take away the accretion, then the system would be almost identical. So that's why I'm still using this analogy. Now, N rotations and toroidal field loops. Toroidal field means there is toroidal pressure, b phi squared over 8 pi. It's pushing up, maybe even sideways.
Is this vacuum, plasma?
Plasma.
Whatever.
Plasma. It's a perfectly conducting plasma fluid everywhere, so that currents can flow. Good point. And then if we wait for too many rotations, then there will be too many field loops. The magnetic pressure will become very high. And this magnetic spring that we've twisted by the rotation will push the gas that was in the way aside. And this magnetic spring will expand and accelerate under its own pressure. So if there is a piece of gas on the spring, it will be accelerated. Another way, a more steady state way that I like to use to think about these jets is the following. So this initial magnetic field line that was sitting and threading through the event horizon is there. And it's continuously reprocessed by the rotation into magnetic field loops that slide down along the original magnetic field lines. They expand in their cross section as the jet cross section expands. And because of that, the magnetic pressure drops. So there is pressure gradient between this and this part because of the increase in the cross section. And therefore, this is what pushes the magnetic field loops and anything that's attached to them out. Actually, let me see. I think I'm missing a slide here. So that's a way that I like to think about jets. Now, if we immerse these jets into ambient medium, then they will wreak havoc in the ambient medium. This is actually one of the most important motivations in trying and understanding how jets work. We want to understand what is their effect on the surroundings, on large scales, on galaxies. And this is a famous X-ray image of the Perseus cluster. If you do some image magic with it, then you will sharpen the contrast and you will see that there are these cavities blown out, presumably by the jets, and there are these sound waves or some sort of perturbations that are propagating outwards. Jets can play an important role in heating up clusters and preventing the on-the-way cooling. How that happens exactly is a mystery. Similarly, in the M87 galaxy, you see cavities blown out by the jets and shocks driven, presumably by the jets, into the ambient medium. There are even more dramatic examples, like this cluster MS0735.6, where these red blobs are the radio emission that is presumably produced by the high-energy plasma, which is part of the jets that were produced by the central supermassive black hole. Blue shows the X-ray emission. If you compute the amount of work, PDV work, that was required to inflate these plasma field cavities, then the energy or this work is essentially equal to the entire rotational energy of the black hole. So it's as if there is some process that just takes the black hole, slows it down, extracts all this energy, and dumps it into the ambient medium. Can jets do that? Can magnetic fields do that? That is an open question. Sorry, let me. I keep hiding slides for some reason, and I'm not sure why I did that. So another way of looking at black hole feedback is to plot the black hole mass versus the stellar velocity dispersion of a collection of supermassive black holes. What we see is a tight correlation known as the M sigma relation. What this seems to suggest is this tiny little dot at the center, which is a supermassive black hole, somehow knows or controls the entire inner part of the galaxy, and there is no obvious way how the two can be related. Perhaps it's a jet feedback, so the jet spews out energy and affects the galaxy on the whole, or perhaps it's radiative feedback, or maybe there are more complicated solutions, such as the black hole in the galaxy is produced by some process that causes them to co-evolve in a way that the two are correlated.
Asha, can I just ask a question about that? Yeah. So the dispersion is in the stars, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So of course their velocity dispersion is just determined by the gravitational field to which they're orbiting.
Yeah.
Just in aerial equilibrium, I see. Mm-hmm. So is it unreasonable to expect, just on kind of general grounds, the mass of the black hole at the center of the galaxy somehow scale to the mass of the galaxy? Or the mass of the local bulge in which the stars are being seen to be orbiting. I mean, I know it's a general hand-wavy argument, but it's, you know.
So, but why?
Because the amount of mass that goes into the black hole may also be related to the amount of mass which is present in the galaxy.
But the black hole mass is about 0.1% of the central bulge.
Sure.
So how can the entire, why not a larger fraction? Why is it 0.1%? Is it a special number? If it were 1, I would understand. But if it's 0.1%...
What I'm saying is the correlation is not unexpected. I would be very unexpected if it went the other way.
We can turn this argument one way or the other.
You're saying there's a correlation there, and it's an unexpected or unexpected correlation, and do you have a detailed model that explains exactly what the percentage ratio is of between massive black hole versus massive?
Well, what I'm saying is how it happens is not understood.
Yeah.
And it could be due to one of these processes, or it could be due to, suggesting some just general formation mechanism that says, oh, well, it's obvious that 0.1% of the stellar, of the bulge of the galaxy in mass will go into the black hole. But, you know, I don't quite know how exactly to arrange that. Any other questions?
Yeah, can you go back to your cartoon, your jet cartoon picture? I mean, it seems to me that the two qualitative descriptions that you provide would suggest very different behavior, and that why wouldn't the spring model predict cyclical behavior and your ring acceleration model predict consistent launching?
These are completely equivalent pictures.
So I understand that you're giving two qualitative descriptions, neither of which are accurate. I'm asking, why is it the case that you can give those two qualitative pictures as being the same, given that, why doesn't this idea of a spring model, you know, why doesn't the spring need to be reloaded and give you something that goes, launches and then comes back, launches and then comes back?
Okay, so sorry, good point. Okay, I apologize. I see how this is actually confusing. The original ceiling here is just because it's easier to explain the fact that the spring is held together and then you load it and then you remove the lid and then it flies out. But in reality, what happens is there is no lid. I mean, unless you are in this T equals zero situation like Jean-Pierre was saying. So if you are in an AGN, there is continuous segments of the spring that come out, push on the segments of the spring that are already there, and then this poor spring has to navigate the ambient medium. So in this sense, the spring analogy is equivalent to this loop analogy. And you can, of course, think of this loop analogy in the context of when it's bottled up. You will be producing more and more loops, toroidal field will grow stronger and stronger, eventually the lid will be blown off and then this entire thing will shoot out. Does that...
Right. So the only way in which your original spring model had a periodicity is if you continually resupplied some magical lid, which you don't.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, good point. Yeah. Okay. Unless there are any questions, which I'm very happy to discuss, because that's the whole point. I want to make sure that this very basic physics of magnetic fields gets some clarity. So how this correlation happens is a good question that many people are working on. And yet another quantitative way of looking at how jets are produced is to plot a radial luminosity, core plus extended, of a bunch of galaxies versus the nuclear B-band luminosity. And there are people who made these plots sitting in this audience. If the nuclear B-band luminosity, or basically the optical light, is a proxy for the accretion luminosity or the accretion rate, then what this plot is telling us is that for the same mass accretion rate, we have two populations, as you see here, radio loud and radio quiet populations, one which is producing much more radio emission than the other. If radio emission is a proxy for jet power, it means that for the same value of mass accretion rate, we can have either a very powerful jet or a very weak jet. So jet power, in addition to black hole mass, which is rather similar between these two populations, maybe within an order of magnitude, and mass accretion rate, which is the same for the same value of x-axis, there is perhaps another parameter, or many parameters, a few parameters, that tell the nucleus whether it will be sitting in the upper or the lower branch, radio loud or radio quiet branch. Here are some possible candidates for this culprit. It could be a magnetic flux that's different between these two. Stronger magnetic flux will give you a higher jet power. Could be differences in the ambient medium. Maybe the intrinsic jet power is the same between these two, but ambient medium is more dense in the upper branch, and so therefore you see more radio emission for the same jet power. Or it could be differences in black hole spin. For instance, these guys can have spins that are higher. Therefore, not surprising, perhaps the jet power will be higher. But there are difficulties with all of these models. It's unclear if any one of them works. Maybe all of them work at some level. Or actually, there is a fourth possibility that this is just a selection effect. And indeed, if you look at the data, then different symbols show different ways the data was sliced. So the ways of detecting these systems were different. And so it's possible that there is actually a continuous distribution. There's really no gap, which is what's hard to explain. So I will leave it at that. But the basic takeaway message right now is that at this stage of the talk is that we have no idea, right? Observationally, there is no clear picture of how jets work. And so maybe what we can do is just look at the pictures and try and get inspired. Please, Jean-Pierre.
Still, there's the fact that only 10% of quasars are radio loud.
That is true. This is, though, I mean,
this is not related or not related to that.
Yeah, I agree. So the quasars are sitting here on this right part. This is where above 1% of Eddington state transitions can happen. So the biggest mystery is here below 1%, so 1% of Eddington, about here, where the accretion disk is expected to be geometrically thick, and therefore you would expect that this disk produces jets robustly. It doesn't have a choice to be thin or thick. So here I agree, this is where this 10% is sitting, but this is less clear. Good point. Any other questions? Yeah, Pasha.
But what's the radio emission of radio quiet objects? Is it thermal?
This is heavily debated right now. It could be a wimpy jet. It could be stellar emission from the stars in the galaxy. Or it could be maybe something else we don't know yet. Maybe there are some other ideas that I don't know of. So it's actually really unclear. Probably it's a combination of the two. In some cases, it's the radio emission from the stars in the galaxy. In other cases, it's the radio emission from a wimpy jet. In some cases, they're pretty similar in contributions to the emission. But there is no generally agreed picture that is accepted in the community right now.
Do we know where the Milky Way would sit on this plot, for example, or nearby galaxies like Andromeda?
So let's see. So for instance, the M87 would be sitting somewhere here. Milky Way would be sitting all the way down there. Something like this, actually. 10 to the minus, yeah, maybe a little bit somewhere here would be M87. Milky Way would be all the way over here. Any other questions? Okay, so let me show you some pictures. These are two of my most favorite supermassive black hole jets. This is the Cygnus A galaxy jet, and this is M87 galaxy jet. At the center, they have very comparable, respectably massive black holes, about 10 billion solar mass black holes. And you can immediately see that even though the central black holes are rather similar, the large scale morphology of the outflows, which perhaps is telling us something about the central engine, is completely different. These morphologies are different. So in this case, the jet is really well collimated and ends up in a hotspot and a puff, whereas in this case, the jet just kind of disappears into these swooshes and one side on the other. The other jet is actually, we think, pointing away from us because it moves relativistically. The emission is beamed away out of our line of sight, so we don't really see the jet itself, but we see its effect, which is very similar to the jet that's pointing towards us. So we think that both jets are there, it's just we don't see the emission in the radio from one of them. So what causes this dichotomy, which is actually been discovered more than 40 years ago, 43 years ago, by Fanaroff and Reilly. These are called Fanaroff-Reilly type 2 jets. These are called Fanaroff-Reilly type 1 jets. So it's a mystery what causes it, and I will come back to it towards the end if I have the time. So this comes back to the picture of when the jets are produced, like Jean-Pierre was asking me. You can classify black hole accretion states by the Eddington fraction, which is the ratio of the escaping luminosity to the Eddington luminosity, which is the luminosity at which the outward radiation pressure is strong enough to lift the accretion flow against gravity by the pressure on the electrons. So if the luminosity is very high, so we're in this regime, Eddington ratio greater than 1, then the accretion flow would be puffed up because there is so much mass supply. The photons have trouble escaping, diffusing out of the accretion flow, so they will be locked up. The accretion flow will not be able to cool radiatively. Most of the viscous dissipation and therefore photon production inside of this accretion flow will be eaten up by the black hole or thrown out by the accretion disk winds. And here we see these jets that I show schematically by the blue arrows. If we decrease the mass accretion rate, then the disk regains ability to cool. It collapses into razor thin disk. And this is the best understood accretion state of all, well described by, or some aspects of it are well described by the Shakuri-Sunyaev, or its general relativistic extension generalization model by Novikov and Thorne. If we drop below 1%, like I discussed earlier, in response to Jean-Pierre's question, then the disks seem to puff up and become radiatively inefficient once again. Here, the physics is different, but the basic idea is that when the density is too low, it's harder for the disk to cool because emission is proportional to density to some power, like density squared or so, and these disks don't really have the time to cool. So they don't radiate and they end up in the black hole or again thrown out. It seems like the jets associated with the disks that are puffed up, maybe because it's more, the disks are more prone to outflows that will hug the jet and make it more collimated. Thicker disks are also possibly more efficient at dragging large-scale magnetic flux inwards, and this is perhaps is a criterion or requirement for production of jets. This is not as simple as just this picture that I showing you, because there are also state transitions between this and this state. If mass accretion rate goes up, so the disk collapses, this seems to cause, observationally at least, the production of fast outflows or jets. And this is seen in black hole binaries. This also could be this explaining perhaps the 10% fraction of quasars that produce jets. This could be quasars caught in the act of state transition between this state and that state. But it's hard to tell whether that's what's going on. So what I'm going to do, at least at the beginning, I'm going to focus on these two states, either the very high mass accretion rate state or the very low mass accretion state, in which case very little radiation that's produced, or very little viscous energy dissipated and the disk is actually escaping as radiation. So I will ignore radiative effects and just focus on the dynamics of the gas and magnetic fields in the gravitational field of the black hole. So let us try and understand how the disk and the jet are connected to each other. This big question of disk-jet connection, we see a jet, we see the disk, and we see connection that is all over the place. So let's try to get it straightened out, at least intuitively. So here is the theorist's view of the central engine. We have a black hole in a vertical slice. We have vertical magnetic field lines. There is also a toroidal field that is in and out of the board, which I don't show here. And there is an accretion disk on an orbit around the black hole. So let us first take this as given, count up the magnetic field lines on the surface of the black hole, or measure the surface field strength, which is B, and ask what is the power of the jets that would be produced this way. So we can estimate this power qualitatively by imagining that this jet is a pipe of some cross-section through which energy flows with some energy density. So cross-section is the R squared. It's the area of the black hole. The energy density is B squared, and the speed at which the energy density flies through this cross-section is C. So energy density times area times speed gives us the energy flux estimate. And it's all modulated by the black hole spin squared, which can vary between 0 and 1. 0 non-spinning black hole, so there will be no rotation and no outflow. 2 maximally spinning black hole, where the dimensionless spin is 1. That will be maximally spinning black hole, maximum power output. It is convenient to rewrite this not in terms of the B field strength, which varies along the jet, but in terms of something that is independent of radius, or the magnetic flux in the jet, so how many field lines are threading the black hole event horizon, which is B times the area, R squared. So then we find this really nice connection that the jet power is the magnetic flux squared times something that depends only on the spin of the black hole and the mass of the black hole. Rg, the gravitational radius, is just basically black hole mass times some numerical prefactor, g over c squared. So this numerical factor I will denote as k, and let's say in active galactic nuclei or black hole binaries, this prefactor k doesn't change in time, at least during our lifetimes. So if we have our favorite black hole, we know that it has a constant k. But we also observe that jet power changes in almost any source. Therefore, all these changes must be coming from the variations in the large-scale magnetic flux on the black hole.
Of course, the long-term k will change.
Yeah, absolutely. But if we observe over the timescale of 10 years in an AGN, the black hole mass will change negligibly small, but yet we see in huge variations in jet power, perhaps by an order of magnitude or more. So how can that happen? And so my thinking is that it must be coming from the large-scale magnetic flux variations. Okay. So what is the... Once we understand that, what will be the range of power that is allowed for the black hole to have? And what is the range of jet power that the black hole can have? Well, the lower limit is clear. If there is no large-scale magnetic flux, if the flux is dynamically not important, if it's subdominant, then the jet power can be as low as you want. It can be zero. The upper limit is less intuitively clear. But what I will show you is that it's comparable to the mass accretion rate times c squared, or the accretion power. That's the energy feeding rate into the black hole in the form of accretion. This corresponds to the maximum value of large-scale magnetic flux that the disk can hold on the black hole. And we can try and see why we expect that there will be a maximum value of magnetic flux intuitively. Let's say we have a black hole, there is some magnetic flux through it, and you know, there is a disk orbiting around. Let's take the disk away for a second. What would happen? This magnetic flux wouldn't stick around in the black hole for a long time because of the no-hair theorem. We know that the black hole can have only two hairs. The mass, how heavy it is, and the spin, or the rotation rate. There is also charge, but we think that our surphysical black holes are not charged. So only two hairs. There is nothing about the magnetic flux. So what will happen is if we remove the accretion disk, then the magnetic flux will just go for a walk. It's basically a magnetic bomb. If you don't hold the magnetic field lines together, they will fly away. Energy doesn't want to stay concentrated. If we put the disk back, then we can add some magnetic flux until a point when this disk is irrelevant. If the magnetic energy is so high that it can just push this disk away against gravity, then it doesn't matter the disk is there. So there must be some limit at which the outward pressure or the outward force of magnetic field F sub B exceeds the force of gravity that's holding the disk together, and at that point the disk is becoming irrelevant, and that's what sets the maximum magnetic flux or the magnetic field strength near the black hole. It's basically gravity. So that's the physics that sets this highest magnetic field strength. And not surprisingly, once the magnetic field is as strong as gravity, or gravity is comparable to the accretion power, then the jet power and the accretion power will be comparable. But I won't get into the details of this beyond the qualitative argument.
But yeah. Couldn't be that it is the inertia of the star which causes magnetic heat, like in this iron pyrite of Ries-Blanford thingy.
That would be fantastic. I would love this if the nature was as kind and as simple to us as that.
What they wrote in their paper. No accretion rate is needed. It is just the inertia of the star.
Yeah,
which
I agree. And so, for instance, as Jean-Pierre correctly pointed out, in isolated pulses, we do see jets. And so if you put mass very far away, then it will not know that gravity is there. It won't care about gravity. So then that mass can turn these pulsar wings around, focus them at the pole, and that way you will get a jet. But if you put mass very close to the black hole, like we think it is in active galactic nuclei, then it's extremely hard to prevent instabilities from running away, such as Rayleigh-Taylor instability. When light magnetic field, this guy is light, this guy is heavy. I don't know if you saw Paul Duffel's talk or, you know, tried to mix coffee and tea, whatever is heavier. I actually don't know which one is heavier. But anyway, the two will try to mix. And so the heavy stuff will eventually make its way, it will find its way to the lowest energy state. That's what I'm finding, and, you know, not surprisingly, the equilibrium state is when there is a competition between the jet and the disk in some way. Any other questions? Okay, by the way, it was not clear that the factor here wouldn't be 10 or 100, or maybe 0.1. So we need a numerical simulation to know what the numerical prefactor is. So when we are in this state, when the magnetic field is dynamically important, this state is called magnetically arrested disk. So this was a work by Ramesh Narayan and Amarik. Another Russian, Igomenshev, yes, thank you. Forget all the Russians. Igor Igomenshev. So they have done the first non-relativistic simulations of magnetically arrested disk accretion onto the black hole, because it was non-relativistic.
Non-rotating, right.
And also there was later on a rotating disk around black hole also by Igor Igomenshev in 2008. And so then yours truly simulated this in GR a few years down the road. So let's look at that. Oh yeah, by the way, before we look at that, let me quantify the strength of jet power. It's convenient to normalize it by the accretion power, so take the ratio of this to that. Okay? So what is this? What does this mean? What is this small p, which is the normalized jet power to the accretion power? Well, let's say you have $100. You would think, huh, $100, I'm going to go to a restaurant and buy everything. Not here. You can't do that. So I suggest an alternative. I mean, $100 is not enough to buy anything, you know, good here. You need at least a few hundred, especially if you're ordering a good bottle of wine or two or three, you know. You can't do that. So let's say you take my offer and you decide to invest your money not in your dinner or your wine, but in science. How can we do that? Direct investment to science. Energy, so mass is energy, energy is money. So we can convert money into energy, into mass, and then we can drop the $100 worth of Rasmus energy into black hole. Okay? So far, so good? Maybe not. But let's measure how much energy comes back out, and let's divide what comes out to what you put in. Let's say $20 worth of energy comes back out, so this little p is 20%, or 0.2, and then you just take off and leave, and I'm crying here and alone in the room because nobody likes me. But let's consider an alternative, and I'll move on to the other side of the board. You put in $100 into the black hole worth of energy, and $150 come back out. So you suddenly, instantaneously, made $50 of energy. So now you can suddenly buy dinner, maybe like almost the full dinner, you know, with the wine in Santa Barbara. So how did this happen? Where did the extra $50 come back from? I mean, you just dropped it into a black hole. Can anything come back out? It turns out it can. Black hole rotational energy is extractable. You cannot extract irreducible energy, which is just the mass without rotation. But if you add rotation to it through accretion, you can then get it back. That's the part of energy of the black hole that actually can be extracted. So if your black hole is rapidly spinning, you can actually get some part of that rotational energy. And if it's really rapidly spinning, then this accretion process can actually give you the $50, you know, extra on top of your $100. So let's see how that happens in action. These are all the different experiments that we can perform. And I will start with this big disk with a lot of magnetic flux, which is shown with the blue arrows. And why I want this is, remember, jet power is proportional to magnetic flux squared. So let me try to get a lot of magnetic flux onto the black hole. And the way I'm going to do it is I'm going to take a really big disk, large area, weak magnetic flux gives you large magnetic flux. So magnetic field weak, but area is large, so the product can be large. That's the idea. I don't want to start with really strong magnetic field because then it will dominate the dynamics, which I don't want. So that's what I do. And that's the initial condition. So the spin of the black hole is 0.99, large disk, weak magnetic field, but large B flux because of large area. And this disk really extends out to basically the ocean. Okay, so on the scale. So it's really, really big. It's about 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 gravitational radii in size. And that also is our size of the box. So our box is big, because our grid is logarithmic, we can do that. So color here shows density. So this is high, that is low. And the contrast is about 1 million. It's a logarithmic scale. Red is 1, blue is 10 to the minus 6. If you look at the horizontal slice, then the black hole will be spinning counterclockwise. The disk will also be spinning counterclockwise. And these black lines are magnetic field lines. So they are initially purely poloidal. What else? These three panels show you that this is not just a movie. It actually has physics behind it. This is the mass accretion rate versus time, how much black hole eats versus time. In arbitrary units. This is dimensionless magnetic flux on the black hole, and this is this dimensionless jet power or jet efficiency, and you can see the dashed line shows the time average. It's about 150 or 1.5, 150%, so you actually are making more than what you put in. So let's run the movie. You see that the initially poloidal field lines get wound up and become toroidally dominated because of the shear in the disk. At the same time, the field lines develop this vertical telltale signs of vertical wiggles, telltale signs of the MRI, magnetorotational instability. The disk becomes turbulent. This turbulence drives angular momentum out, mass and magnetic flux in. So you see that the mass is being eaten by the black hole. Magnetic flux on the black hole increases, it goes up. And the jet power also increases because, as you remember, it goes as a flux squared. So there are more and more magnetic field lines, they're stronger, we see these two nice, healthy jets. But as the magnetic flux goes up higher and higher, eventually it reaches the maximum at which it is able to push the disk aside, and that's what happens when the disk, when the jet denses. This is when the magnetic flux bundles leave the black hole because they're too strong for the disk to hold them together, and they escape into the disk, and they buoyantly rise through the disk because it's like an air of, like a bubble of air in a pond of water. It raises upwards against gravity, and so these bubbles of magnetic flux are being expelled. You can see them here as under densities. So this is another bubble, and it will be rising buoyantly as it's being sheared out and mixed back into the accretion flow by the Keplerian shear. So you have the circulation of large-scale magnetic flux. It's being thrown out of the black hole, getting mixed back into the accretion flow, and being presented to the black hole again. So it's a very green system, self-sufficient. Okay, we are conserving the magnetic flux here, not letting it go far away.
What about the mass? How much of the mass is getting out and coming back down?
It's a great question. The mass, most of the mass that is here is going to be, on average, eaten by the black hole within 10 gravitational radii. Things that are outside of 10 gravitational radii, they have a higher likelihood that they're actually going to be blown out in the form of the wind. The standard picture that emerges is that the mass accretion rate that goes into the black hole is a function of radius. It scales as radius to the power of 1/2. Well, maybe beyond 10 gravitational radii. So this is the dependence outside of 10 gravitational radii. Inside, it's roughly constant. So if you go to radius of 1,000, then only about 10% of that mass that is falling in will actually reach the black hole. 90% of that mass will be blown out by the disk winds. No. Go ahead, and then Mark.
What sets the initial orientation of the magnetic
field? That is a great question. My hands are setting the orientation of the magnetic field. By hand, I actually spent literally maybe 2 or 3 months when I was finding a way of packing this magnetic field uniformly into the torus. It's not trivial. I cannot make up monopoles. I cannot just say, I want a field of this strength here. I need to take the magnetic field lines and distribute them evenly such that I resolve the MRI everywhere initially, and so on and so forth. So it was yours truly, hands, that did the magnetic fields. But because my hands can do whatever they want, right? I will show you the results of simulations for different field geometries. In reality, we actually have no clue what the field geometry is. It can be horizontal field instead of vertical. And actually, I have a simulation for that. I showed it in the talk in February, and I think I might show it again because it's such a cool result. Turns out if the field is even like this, the jet still forms, somewhat mysteriously. But our picture is that these simulations have these fields very close in because I put them by hand, but in reality, these fields are probably far away outside the Bondi radius, which is like 10 to the 6 gravitational radii. They're threading the ISM. The strength is about microgauss. And so if you take that patch of ISM and drop it on the black hole, then perhaps something like this, what I simulate here, happens, provided that the field orientation will be vertical. Okay. In fact, there is enough large-scale magnetic flux in a 100 times 100 parsec square patch with the 1 microgauss field enough to saturate the black hole with magnetic flux, like in this simulation. So that's the picture. This flux is brought in by the accretion flow from large radii, dumped on the black hole, and then we see this jet. If I were to make it even more abstract, my question is purely theoretical. If there was large-scale magnetic flux near the black hole, what could we get using it? How much in the form of a jet could we get? And that's the answer. You cannot do much more than about 150% or so. So 400% is what you can get. Does it answer your question?
Yeah, I think so.
We can talk more about it. Marek, and then you.
It is not a question, and probably not very important. But years ago, Igor Igumenshev seen the same bubbles, purely hydro simulations.
Oh, no, not hydro. Purely non-relativistic simulations, you mean? Yeah.
Purely non-relativistic, purely hydro, yes. There were the same bubbles. I mean, not the same, but very similar.
Yeah. No, I mean,
like this, which we see now.
And he was very happy when I showed him, because he's like, yes, the same thing works in the black hole. Yes, I had a long chat with him. He was very happy. So, yeah, he did not complain that the bubbles looked similar. Yeah.
Clarify, so you said about 10% of the mass gets ejected in the
wind? 10%, so if you go to, if you ask how much mass is falling in at 10 gravitational radii to the black hole versus how much gets to the black hole, it's 100%. If you go out to 1,000 gravitational radii and you ask how much of the mass at the 1,000 gravitational radii that's going towards the black hole gets to the black hole, it will be only 10%.
So I'm looking at the amount of mass being ejected in jet funnel. So how much mass is being ejected in the blue region, which looks like it's expanding.
The blue region doesn't have almost any mass. It's basically hollow.
So essentially all of this energy extraction is in the form of electromagnetic energy.
Most of it. Exactly. Maybe, so out of 150%, about maybe 20% is in the form of, actually through the accretion disk, because accretion disk can also extract energy at some efficiency. And that contribution is about 20% to the 150% or so. So most of it is really coming in the electromagnetic form. Oh, right, there was some other question? No? Okay, let me wrap this thing up. We can then run simulations for different values of spin, counter-rotating, retrograde, maximally spinning, prograde, maximally spinning. And so each of these data points is a few simulations for different resolutions, for slightly different disks. You know, I wanted to make sure that the details don't matter. What really matters is just large-scale magnetic flux is large. You find is that there is less power coming out for non-spinning black holes, much more for prograde, and somewhat less for retrograde black holes. You can break this up, as you were asking, into the black hole contribution and the disk contribution. So this comes out in the form of disk wind. This comes out in the form of black hole power jet. So that's the green one. And you can see that the disk contribution is at most 20%, just as Richard asked, like we discussed. When we go to below about spin of 0.3, then the disk contribution starts to outshine the black hole contribution. Not surprisingly, black hole cannot do much if it's not spinning. One thing that I wanted to say is that these jets, because we maximize the magnetic flux, they're really much more powerful than anything that people have simulated before. You really need to put as much magnetic flux as the black hole would take, and then you will maximize the power of the jet for a given mass accretion rate. Because the jets are so strong, it actually will slow down the black hole to a halt. So if you measure the spin-up parameter, which is how much the spin would grow by had you double the black hole mass, that's what you can think of. So if it's positive, then the black hole will be spun up. In this case, the black hole will be spun down. The other way around. Here, the black hole will be spun up. Here, the black hole will be spun down. And so for the thin disk, this is the spin-up curve. So if you're here, then the black hole is being spun up all the way down to the maximal spin. In this case, the black hole will be spun down all the way down to spin zero. The MADS, they actually slow down the black holes to an equilibrium spin of about 0.07, essentially zero, as opposed to thin disks that spin up the black holes to essentially spin of one. These magnetic fields are put there by hand. Are they available in nature? It seems that there are observational evidence. There's observational evidence that there are large-scale magnetic fields near the black holes that are dynamically important in tidal disruptions, gamma ray bursts, in blazers, low luminosity IGN. So it's quite exciting. And I can even show you some of the details of how we can infer those, but I think I'm running out of time. Let me see if I can show you something else in the last minute that I don't have. Let's see. I wanted to switch to something that will hopefully get some excitement from the front row here. What about neutron stars? Every time I come to a conference, Jean-Pierre asks, guys, black holes are cool, but neutron stars are even cooler. We want accretion onto neutron stars and one jets from neutron stars. Am I conveying your message right correctly? Yes. Okay, Jean-Pierre is nodding. So unlike black holes, neutron stars have their own magnetic field. So in principle, you don't have to have accretion in order to produce a jet. But there are complications. How does this field interact with the field in the disk? And can the neutron stars produce jets because there's this closed magnetosphere, and then maybe the disk will just swamp the open magnetic flux and nothing will happen, so there will be no energy brought out. So in order to simulate this, it's actually extremely challenging. It's more challenging than to simulate black hole accretion, and the reason for this is the dipole fields have magnetic field strength that's dropping very rapidly as 1/r³. And because of that, If you want to have a decent magnetization where the disk interacts with the magnetosphere or at the light cylinder, let's say you want magnetic fields to dominate rest mass energy by a factor of 80, which is pretty good. In reality, it should be essentially infinity, or maybe 10 to the 6. You will be ending up with this magnetic field energy density over rest mass energy density at the surface of the star of at least 10 to the 4. This is ridiculous. It's extremely hard to simulate this, because if you make a 1% error in magnetic field, it will be translated into a 10,000% error in rest mass. So rest mass will just go nuts, the simulation will explode. So you cannot just use MHD to simulate this. You have to find a way of combining MHD in the accretion flow with something that is robustly handling high energy, so high magnetization regions in the polar regions, which is force-free method. So Kyle Parfrey and I have been working for the past couple of years on trying to find this this approach of handling this. And in fact, he and I have been able to do this. So force-free-like evolution will be applied to the polar regions where there is mostly magnetic flux, and MHD equations will be applied in the rest.
And of course, it's not the magnetization of the star unit, it's the magnetization of the flow.
Magnetization, so...
Because very highly magnetized stars never show jets, for example.
Maybe. What we're solving these equations from first principles, and we are going to ask. We don't know what the answer is. Let's say I'm an ignorant theorist, and I don't know what happens in observations. I know that neutron stars have dipolar fields, and I know that there is a disk around them. Let me put the disk around the neutron star the same exact way as I did it with the black hole and let it go. Press enter and see what happens. So we see jets from neutron stars, and we know that there are transitional pulsars, where the pulsar goes from being a pulsar to being an accreting neutron star. So there has to be a transition between a pulsar where there is no accretion at all to a neutron star where the mass accretion rate is pretty low. So probably the magnetosphere won't be crushed. And just to simulate that is enough of a motivation to try and study the systems in general. So this is our initial condition. It looks a little bit funny. And the reason for this is nothing is spinning. This t equals zero, theoretical t equals zero. So we have closed field lines. Then we open them up by hand, make them hug around the accretion disk which we inserted. All of this is done because in reality, first we want to have a pulsar magnetosphere that's spinning, that's producing the pulsar wind, and then the accretion disk invades that wind. But because we cannot invade that wind from infinity, we bring it down to maybe 60 neutron star radii. That's why we want to do this. If it's not clear, then just ignore that. It doesn't really matter. So if we run the simulation, so all this part here will be done in MHD. Everything else around here is essentially force-free. So that's really the challenge. And there is a boundary that's been tracked by algorithm where the two switch. So these are magnetic field lines, as before. Red is high density. Blue is low density. This is log rho. That's a neutron star. Its radius is about 4 gravitational radii in our simulations. And what we will see is that this heavy disk will fight through this pulsar wind that is shooting plasmoids at it. Because it's heavy enough, it doesn't care. It just goes through. It will get into the light cylinder, which is shown with the vertical line, where the rotation would have become faster than the speed of light. See it. It really, like a needle, pinches the closed zone, and then eventually it finds its way to the surface and accretes.
But surely the accretion is going to be onto the magnetic caps.
That's what's happening.
And can your simulation say anything about the likely time behavior?
They can. The only difficulty with addressing your very important question is because right now we only have simulations for aligned neutron stars. So there will be no time variability because of the polar cap rotation if it were tilted. Is that what you're asking about?
Yes, you can probably guess why I'm asking in a simulation like this. Are you getting at all close to the kind of configuration that Anna was talking about in the ULX pulsars?
So this actually might be, this is one of the motivations, for sure, to try and understand what sort of configurations you get. This is actually a ULX pulsar simulation. Modulo the strength of the magnetic field, we need to get it right. We need to know what mass accretion rate we're talking about, what's the field strength on the surface, and we actually haven't done the calculation. This is, in a sense, a scale-free simulation that you can apply to anywhere.
Well, right, because seeing that, that's once again, I think, an exact replica of what Paul Joss and company were talking about 40 years ago to explain the extraordinary time dependence of the rapid burster.
I'm excited as you are. So you can see that here you can have quite interesting effects, depending on the orientation of the magnetic flux in the disk, you can actually have these magnetic field lines try to close and not quite lead to the jet that's powered by the open magnetic field lines. If you were to invert the orientation, then they would be open. The invert orientation of the magnetic flux in the disk, they could be open. So you can have two different types of neutron star accretors, ones that produce jets easier, ones that produce the jets in a harder way. So here, for instance, there is no jet at all from the central compact object, but there will be an outflow from the accretion disk, so you will see something. Perhaps this is a ULX. But more likely, there is an open magnetic flux that's mass-loaded, and the time variability of the polar cap that's rotating will be imprinted on the optically-thick outflow, and it's the variation of this outflow as it crosses from under the photosphere is what you see in as pulsations. That's my best guess for these.
Now, the danger that washes it out, though?
Could wash it out, but if you just have this, it's a conveyor belt of variability that's propagating out. But that's what has to be happening. I don't know of an alternative. I'm happy to talk about that. We can also have more fun, and we can try and increase the magnetic field strength or decrease the mass accretion rate and see if a disk will be able to penetrate the light cylinder then. And what you will see here is that in this case, the accretion stream, even though sometimes it reaches inside the light cylinder, it actually never reaches the surface. That's quite exciting. Our initial idea was to try and demonstrate transition between an isolated pulsar, accreting pulsar, and back an isolated pulsar. The previous simulation demonstrated the transition from isolated to accreting. We couldn't quite manage to get it all in one simulation. This is a simulation that shows that it doesn't have to accrete if the magnetic field is too strong. So in fact, it will sit around most of the time just like that. But there will be one period of time that one of these tons will reach in and almost make it.
Sasha, if you have a mass transfer system where the secondary can't help but transfer matter over to the accretion disk, build up the matter there, and you have active accretion through that, but truncated at this in a way, what do you know? Expect to happen eventually, wouldn't the mass in the disk eventually pile up sufficiently that the magnetic field just doesn't have the ability to push back because the ram pressure of the accretion flow?
That is a great question.
There's a ram pressure versus magnetic pressure argument here.
That's exactly what's happening here. That's exactly right. So here our mass of the disk is fixed and the entire disk is just blown away. If you were to keep supporting it, then depending on the rate which you support, you can have two cases. One is you overwhelm eventually, and then the disk will clear out, and then it will be pushed back again.
Yeah.
If you supply not fast enough, then the disk will not be able to be replenished. Yeah, exactly. There could be also an intermediate case, which is a little bit more perhaps fine-tuned, when most of the disk mass will be blown out in the form of the disk. So if you supply the mass, but not too fast, so that the disk wind can take it out, so you get a steady state, you could get something like that.
Okay, so I don't get that there's no interaction between the field and the matter, because
Sorry, when here?
Rotation seems to be constant, right?
You mean this guy
doesn't slow down? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The time scales are so short that will not be simulated. We don't include that. But, of course, one of the very important things that we're going to try and match to the observations is I'm trying not to be too ignorant of observations.
Yeah, it's too short in the.
Yeah. In fact, I am actually really interested in observations, so I would like to talk to all of you guys if you have any suggestions. Is what would be the torques on the neutron star? Because that's what you observe. And how they depend on the magnetic field geometry and the mass accretion rate and so on the tilt.
Those field lines are dipolar, so this is not the extent of your box, right?
No, obviously. The box so actually goes out to hundreds and hundreds of gravitational radii in this case. Yeah.
Okay, so it's still closed field lines.
So all of these field lines will eventually close, exactly right. Okay. They were closed initially behind the disk, and they're still closing, exactly right. Okay, so I can either finish right now, or I can show you a little bit of large-scale jet interaction with the ambient medium. You guys tell me how you feel about it. It will take me about 5 minutes to wrap it up. Or I can wrap it up right now. It's up to you.
No.
I'll be happy to carry on.
Okay, cool. This is kind of, I try to reflect the title of this talk, that it's across different objects. So we can get jets in a binary merger gamma ray burst, where the jets will be perhaps collimated by the merger injector and the accretion disk wind. So this will be a short gamma ray burst, for instance, or from this angle line of sight, it will be a kilonova, perhaps. In a core collapse gamma ray burst, it's the same thing, except now we have a star, so the scale is a stellar radius. And then we'll have one duration gamma ray bursts that are escaping. And in AGN, we will have ambient medium, accretion flow. This is the ISM of the kiloparsec scales, and the AGN jets have to navigate this interstellar medium. So you see that there is striking similarity between all these systems of disparate scales. There is a common challenge, is that in all these cases, we see high energy emission or the dissipation in the jets. And perhaps this mechanism is universal. It seems like observationally, this mechanism converts 10 to 50% of jet power into high energy emission. And how can you do this? Magnetic reconnection is perhaps one of the mechanisms. Since we have outflow, which is magnetically dominated initially, perhaps we can take a small fraction of this energy and convert it into emission somehow. So if we were to reconnect magnetic field energy, then the energy will be dumped into accelerating particles, and then we will see the high energy emission. But how can it work generically? Because remember, we have this large-scale magnetic flux, which is smooth. How can you make this magnetic flux and twist it onto itself so that it reconnects automatically? And so let me show you an example of an AGN. This is M87 jet. This is a Chandra X-ray image with the contours in X-rays. You can also look at the same jet in Hubble, and you can see that there is a core, which is the central part of the AGN, that is unresolved, and there is a bright spot, which is HST1, and then there are a few other spots almost regularly placed until the jet falls apart further out. So what are these? What causes this dissipation? We see it in the optical, we see it in the X-rays, we probably see some of these spots in the high energy emission, we don't know where it comes from. So how can we try and simulate that? And what we think is going on here is that somewhere within this small box, small scale compared to the rest, we have a black hole, we have a accretion disk wind that collimates the jet as we saw in the simulations. Then this jet rams into the ambient medium at what people usually call the Bondi radius, where the black hole gravity is not important compared to the gravity of the gas. And then when the jet realizes that it's run into the ambient medium, it will have to readjust, perhaps going through recollimations. Perhaps these are the recollimations that we're seeing here, including the HST1. Maybe that's where you see some sort of dissipation. And then the jet deposits the rest of the energy that's left into the ambient medium. In fact, there are observational clues that there is something going on at the Bondi radius, the jet inside the Bondi radius. So this is the radius away from the center, and this is the cross section of the jet. You see that it's parabola-like all the way out to 1D radius, and then it is a cone-like further away. So jet seems to be collimating in here and becoming straight further out, and this transition happens just around the 1D radius, perhaps where the jet starts to interact with the ambient medium. So let's try to simulate this interaction. And this is the final snapshot of this interaction. So this is a jet at large distances where it's drilling the ambient medium. The central object is somewhere over there. If we zoom in, this is a telltale sign of jet interacting with the ambient medium. The jet would want to go sideways, but it runs into the ambient medium, so it gets recollimated. And then it does something to try and come to terms with it. And what we are seeing here in color is the ratio of magnetic to gas pressure. So initially, magnetic pressure much exceeds the gas pressure, but as the jet runs into the ambient medium and adjusts, then you see the magnetic pressure gets converted into thermal energy of the gas pressure. So there is dissipation that's happening here. And how does it work? We see these magnetic field lines that getting twisted and starting to wrap around instead of being straight. So this is an internal kink instability. And perhaps this dissipation associated with it is powering HST1 and high energy emission. You can see here that initially nicely wound up flux bundle gets kinked sideways due to the development of what we call internal kink instability. And you can't really see at this resolution, but these magnetic field lines were really tightly wound. But once they start kinking, they become kind of straight. So this toroidal energy got dissipated away through a reconnection, the energy of the magnetic field got deposited into the thermal energy. This is yet another view of this. The streamlines were regular. When the field lines converge, they become turbulent. As they do so, the magnetic field, so this is streamlines, this is magnetic field lines, different representations of them. I won't get into details, but magnetic field lines become really tangled, and then they become regular once you get out of this recollimation region, which means that you've lost all of this energy in the tangled field, which was the toroidal component. So that's how jets perhaps radiate. But remember, there was this problem of understanding what causes the jets to look completely different at large scales. This is a pretty big problem. So some jets make out of their galaxies. The length of this jet is 70 kiloparsecs. And this guy is only 5 kiloparsecs long. So how can this be happening? What causes this difference? Is it the ambient medium or the central object that's different or the accretion form is different? Or maybe this is the same magnetic instability that we just saw operating large scales. So I will skip the theory and I will just show you these two movies, and this is where I end up with my talk. So this is a powerful jet. This is a low power jet. This is the Bondi radius. Not Bondi radius. This is the radius of the galaxy, 10 kiloparsecs in both cases. So this is a zoomed in simulation. Blue shows density, blue is low, a yellow is high, and I trace out one magnetic field line. So let's focus on this simulation first. High power jet. You see that the jet is nothing else than the spring that's twisted by the rotation of the central object, as I started my talk with. And the spring is bendable, so when it navigates the density, it can bend. But this bending never causes the jet to fall apart because the jet is powerful enough and the instability is not very strong. And you can see that as the jet enters the ambient medium, it drilled a hole and the exhaust goes back, similar to what you see in the powerful FR2 sources. In the weak jets, this one is 100 times less powerful than that. That's the only difference between these two simulations. The jet develops an internal instability, ties itself into a knot, and it really can't propagate any further. Which is kind of similar to what we see in observations here. Also, the exhaust seems to outrun the jet just like here because the jet can propagate. There is a lot of exhaust that outruns the jet. So it's possible that this discrepancy in the jet shapes is just due to the physics of the magnetic fields. So it can be telling us about the jet power and the ambient density or the ratio of the two. Perhaps it can be used to as yet another way of measuring the power of the jets and the relation to the properties of the galaxy. These are my conclusions. Strong magnetic fields are cool. jets from neutron stars are possible in theory and in observations. And jet morphology can be changed beyond recognition by the magnetic instabilities. Thank you. Everything is great. Everybody wants tea and coffee, so sorry for running over.
When you mentioned this cake, it reminds me, this is about history. In the old days before you were born, Sky X1 was observed to have two jets. And it was a big mystery because it was aligned, you know, there was the radio center, radio source in the center of Sky X1 and two small, you know, spots, radio spots, and they were not moving, which was a big mystery. How could you have, you know, ejected from Sky X1 not moving? And then there was a paper by several people, I think Martin Rees was in that, in Nature, and they were explaining by a cake instability.
Oh.
But there was a cake, and since it was a cake, it was not moving because it was placed in it. And the end of the story is that with improved radio observation, they found this with two background radio galaxies.
I'm glad I didn't.
But the cake was there.
So, in the case of the neutron stars, it's powered by open solar magnetic flux, but it doesn't start that way, right? It's the open field lines have to develop from the closed dipole fields. And so presumably, that's just a result of things being blown away and carrying the magnetic flux with them.
So these magnetic field lines here are
open because of the lights. Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. They open automatically. In at least in these rapidly rotating neutron stars.
Okay, so then my question is, for protostellar systems, you don't have.
They would still get opened up by the. So, if there is a field line that connects to the disk, mm-hmm. And the conditions are right, as you will see here in this case, actually they don't have to open; they can be closed, but. In the black holes, it's the same. You have a magnetic field loop. The inner part of it gets into the black hole. The outer part is still attached to the disk. You rotate the central source, generate these loops, and these loops have pressure, so they want to open up this magnetic field line and push it away. So that's a mechanism by which you can open close magnetic field lines, similar to what I showed in this cartoon very initially in the talk. But it doesn't have to be. Here you see that there are open magnetic field lines, sometimes the field lines just close. So this can lead to intermittency and all sort of interesting things. If the orientation of the magnetic field would be the opposite, then the field lines would always be open because they wouldn't be able to reconnect with the field from the disk. So in that case, you will generically expect a jet. I just chose to show this because it had more action happening here. Any other questions?
Okay, in these simulations that you do with a power frame, there should be a spin down torque by the jet. So what is it dominated with? Is it like pointing flux like in the pulsar, but just enhanced due to increased amount of open field lines?
So we haven't yet looked at that in detail, but it doesn't have to be necessarily spin down. It could be spin up or spin down, depending on whether the star is rotating faster or slower than the equilibrium spin.
Okay, but of course we can estimate more or less what is the spin up torque by the accretive matter, but there should be a spin down contribution from the jet.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about.
So yeah. So both of them are happening at the same time, and depends on the spin of the star to start with. If the star spins faster than the equilibrium spin, then it will be out of equilibrium, and then it will be slowed down. If it spins spins slower than the equilibrium spin, then it will be spun up. And I actually don't know whether this particular simulation is above or below the equilibrium spin. But that's something that we're going to look at and try and quantify the spin up and spin down torques on the neutron star, and we'll compare them to the jet. In this case, there is no large-scale jet at all. Because the field lines are mostly closed. So I would expect that most of the interaction is dominated by just the interaction of the neutron star magnetosphere with the disk. The jets would not be carrying a substantial amount of energy or angular momentum. But these are all great questions. This is the purpose of these simulations. We want to understand precisely that. Are jets important? Do they change the spin down properties of the star? Can you get a spin reversal, you know, spin up, spin down reversal, as was observed in at least one case? We also would like to understand, I mean, these are two-dimensional simulations. In 3D, things can be different. You can open up the field lines and fall through. You can also have effects of the tilt. All of these things are interesting for us. So that will be part of the future study, this project.
Can I ask one more question?
Jean-Pierre.
Oh, okay.
Can Pasha ask another question?
Sorry?
Can Pasha ask another question? Because you're playing the role of Omer. Daniel, okay, fine.
It is almost 10:30, so people should feel free to leave if they want to, but otherwise, let's go ahead.
Discussion.
Okay. One last question.
Go for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that in the case of M87, there are signatures for probably the collimation region is resolved. So there are signatures that the collimation angle decreases in the resolved region of the size of around the parsec.
So maybe even more, like 100 parsec or so. You resolve.
Yes, even more. So it's not collimated by the inner disk. It's collimated by the ambient medium.
So the Bondi radius is about 100 parsec in M87, there is a continuous power law that appears to extend from very close into far away. Some people say there is a break, maybe at around 30 gravitational radii, but it's hard to make it out from the data. In our simulations, without any ambient medium, the jets actually get collimated out to thousands and tens of thousands of gravitational radii by the outflow from the disk. The way I think of it is there is an accretion disk, and there is a jet in the middle, but the disk produces this outflow that tries to fill the entire domain. And so this outflow provides some pressure support as a function of